Gateway Market and Cafe is Des Moines' locally owned grocery and specialty food store, centrally located at ML King Parkway and Woodland Ave. Enjoy chef-crafted prepared foods, artisan baked goods, organic produce, hand-cut meats, local and international cheeses, wines, and craft beer. Gateway's Cafe is open for dine-in, carry-out, and delivery service 7 days a week. Stop by or visit gatewaymarket.com for more details. Gateway Market, good food, great community. Hey folks, welcome to the Fallon Forum. This is Ed Fallon, your host, and we're broadcasting from the heart of America's heartland, Des Moines, Iowa. And you know, we got content, of course, that is important to you wherever you live. And I thank the affiliate stations around the country that share this program. Hey, underwriting provided by Gateway Market, a Des Moines grocery and cafe offering artisan local and global foods and catering for business and social events. More information at gatewaymarket.com. Hey, our program's bumper music is provided by the Des Moines Iowa Session. And later in the show, we're going to be talking about the 25th Amendment, and whether that applies to political reality right now. We'll also talk about something called the varieties of democracy relevant to authoritarianism. We'll also do a deep dive into Cuba. And Kathy and I will discuss how ranchers are feeling about grazing on conservation land. First, though, we're going to kick it off with a conversation about Trump's, quote, deal regarding Iran. And with me for this and other conversations is Jeffrey Weiss. He's the poli-sci prof at Des Moines Area Community College. He's on the show a lot because he has a lot of good ideas. Jeffrey, you better have good ideas today. Don't let me down.
Yeah, I'll try.
Okay. So you've been following what's going on in Iran. I didn't even know where to start. So many questions. Okay, Trump's talking about a deal. How different, or how does Trump's, quote, deal compare to the one that Obama and company negotiated that he canceled, the Iran nuclear deal from way back when? That, you know, it seems to me like that, quote, deal made a lot of sense compared to some. And yet, you know, again, Trump cancels it. Now he wants to do a deal with Iran that doesn't accomplish anywhere near as much as that deal did. Do I have that right?
Yeah, and we don't know if there will be a deal. I mean, we hope that something will take place so that the war comes to a close. But I guess I'd start out by saying for years when there was discussion of war against Iran, the question was, would Iran close the Strait of Hormuz? And this time they did it. And so Iran understands that just with missiles, drones, boats, and mines, four simple things, they can shut down the global economy to some extent, or at least make life painful for people around the world. Iran doesn't need to make a deal. Time is on their side because
the more pain
that they can inflict on the president, the better deal that they'll get.
They're not inflicting any pain on the president. They're inflicting pain on the Americans who buy gas or food, all these other things that have gone up in price because of this war in Iran.
Yeah, and even more so for people around the world. But
sure.
What
yes,
the president is concerned about is his own political survival and the survival of his political party for the midterms. So the closer that we get to the midterms, what most economists are saying is that we haven't seen the worst of this. If it continues by July, you're going to see inflation that is going to increase by 1, 2, 3%, and the pain will even be greater.
So you're saying if the war in Iran continues?
Yes, or even the status quo. The administration is desperate to change the status quo because what they tried to impose is a blockade on a blockade, and that hasn't worked. And the real difficult thing with the negotiations is that what the United States wants immediately is some nuclear deal, what you ask in your question. But Iran wants that to be the last deal made, because they understand that if that deal is made, the United States can go back on all the other deals they make about the Strait of Hormuz, about, you know, their missile program, all of these particular things.
Wait, the U.S. government going back on a deal that's been made? That's never happened before, Jeffrey.
Well, you know...
Right? Yeah. I mean, I'm kidding, of course.
No, and really, whatever deal, if it happens, will not be nearly as good as what the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action was, which took 17 months JCPOA.
That was Obama's deal.
Absolutely, right. which essentially sent the uranium, I mean, sent nuclear material to Russia. Only 3% grade. Right now, Iran is allegedly up to 50 or 60% grade.
So you're saying, hold on, for lack of any interest in saying a long name, the Obama deal. how do you rate that in terms of its success at limiting Iran's nuclear weapons expansion?
It was extraordinarily successful. And the IAEA said that it was successful. International Atomic Energy Agency, right, of the United Nations. The five members of the Security Council plus Germany that signed up for this deal and monitored this deal said it was successful. And really, the Trump administration cannot hope to get, I don't know, anything close to that deal in their wildest dreams, because Iran holds, I guess we call it, the Trump card, which is the Strait of Hormuz.
Cute.
You know, and the pain in terms of the global economy is being felt, you know, mostly by South Asia, you know, people in India, people in Somalia.
Well, in the U.S. as well, but more acutely in those countries.
Absolutely, yeah. because it's affected food, access to food, you know, but access to a lot of the necessities of life.
Take me, if you can do this, take us back a little walk through history here. Why did Trump back in, was it 2017, I guess, why did he insist on canceling the agreement between Iran and the U.S.
Weapons? Israel and the Israeli lobby always hated that deal. As all of us know, the government of Israel has a disproportionate influence on U.S. foreign policy and U.S. domestic policy, although that influence is waning, especially amongst the Democratic Party, where if you get money from pro-Israeli lobbies, it can be a death knell.
And it's been the opposite until recently.
Right.
I mean, I have my own little experience with AIPAC when I ran for Congress. But there are, you know, pro-peace members of Congress, Not anti-Israel, but right, but who want to see equality and fairness and justice for the Palestinian people. And they get primaried with a lot of help from AIPAC money, and they lose. And even Jewish members of Congress.
Yep, and an extremely high percentage of Jewish Americans who are now, you know, who are really not comfortable with the violations of the Genocide Convention that are ongoing in Gaza. So, but when it comes to foreign policy, you know, this is the first president that decided to, you know, in part, you know, answer to, in this case, Netanyahu, and start this war. And now he's now the administration finds itself in a no-win situation.
So let me back up. You think that President Trump initiated military engagement with Iran specifically because Netanyahu, Israel's president, wanted him to do so?
You know, according to reporting from the New York Times and of other, I think, good reporting, it's clear that it had a huge effect. I mean, yeah, that it did have
the deciding factor.
Perhaps. It's hard to get inside of his head.
And Netanyahu's interest in seeing the U.S. at war with Iran is?
Israel's goal is to create, if they can, the facts on the ground in Iran to have a civil war. I mean, they've tried to arm the minorities in Iran. It hasn't worked because, you know, it's a country of 93 million, but more than 60 million are Persians. They have a 4,000-year civilization. They're throughout the country. And so Israel is interested in having a larger regional hegemony in the region itself. Whereas, you know, the United States is interested in oil and resources and economics, but also the United States has always been interested in having an alliance with the only country in the region that has nuclear weapons, which is Israel.
And just saying that that destabilizing Iran helps the radical elements that currently control the Israeli government.
That's their assessment. I'm not here to say that it's rational or logical. It's just that is what they're also trying to do in Lebanon. They're trying to create a civil war.
What they've done in Gaza.
And
in the West Bank.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And they're, you know, violations of the Genocide Convention in Gaza and, you know, ethnic cleansing in the West Bank. But
and it's a concern that Iran is actively working to prevent Israel's expansion.
Yes, and also that Iran supports and has supported Hezbollah.
For that reason,
Hamas
though.
At time. Yeah, and the Houthi rebels.
I'm not condoning that either.
Yeah. Yeah, and really, the other thing about the Strait of Hormuz now is it is possible that the Houthi rebels could make things real difficult in the Red Sea for shipping. It is also possible, we've been hearing reports, that some of the underground cables in the Persian Gulf could be destroyed.
Underground cables that carry what?
Oil.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
And
pipes?
And, well, you can call them cables or pipes. I'm not sure what the
more like a power
line
of some sort.
Yeah, yeah. What, you know, maybe that's not the proper technology. I guess I'm just envisioning it.
Mm-hmm.
Like a big, thick pipe. But I don't know what I'm calling a cable.
I'll
call it a pipe. But, and really what Iran is saying over and over now is that if the war is resumed, the war will be not just, missiles will not just fly on Israel, the long-range ones they still have. They won't just fly on the Gulf countries, but the war is going to take place outside of these regions, which I think is a pretty clear indicator that Iran, which is a country that is facing two countries with nuclear weapons, two countries with genocidal intentions in terms of, we know what Israel has said and done. We also know that the President of the United States has threatened to destroy a country and a civilization of at least the Persians, 60 to 70 million people, but a country of 90 million. He's inferred that he could, destroy all of them. That's a lot of people.
This is blowhard, you know.
But if you're Iran considered to be an existential threat, and so, you know, one hopes that the war doesn't resume because it could take us to places that nobody would be comfortable with, let alone the polls that show that the overwhelming majority of the United States citizens never wanted this war in the first place, which is rare. Oftentimes, even if presidents have to lie their way into war, like weapons of mass destruction in March 2003 invading Iraq, you still, at the beginning, have some support. There's very, very little support amongst the U.S. citizenry for war. In fact, citizens are tired of our war economy, our perpetual war, our empire military bases.
Which I think is why the Trump administration is trying to find a way out of this quagmire that they created.
That's true.
And but one quick look at within Iran, just prior to our launching an attack on them, there was a significant civilian uprising against the tyrannical government. I mean, again,
and that has been weakened severely because the current Ayatollah is
the son of the one that we killed.
Absolutely, he comes from the Revolutionary Guard, and even though he was injured in the bombing which killed the supreme leader, now predictably the Revolutionary Guard is in power, and so as Iran develops, if it can be, inducted more into the global economy, it may become a little less of a theocracy and a little bit more of a country that's run by the Revolutionary Guards. And they're going to be much more difficult to deal with. So what the United States has done and Israel is they have assassinated the pragmatic leaders in the country, the people who they could deal with, and also the people who held out not wanting a nuclear weapon. The former Ayatollah issued a fatwa, and they have now put into power people who are not only much likely, more likely to suppress the population, mm-hmm. but more likely to move towards centrifuges and create a nuclear weapon.
So let's assume that Trump is able to, you know, put together some kind of agreement that ends the war in Iran, that keeps the Strait of Hormuz open, keeps the oil flowing, which has its own problems. Let's say he's able to do that in the next couple months, or even less. Will that affect the will that affect his popularity in the polls and the potential, you know, outcome of the November election?
Yeah, I don't think it'll make a big difference because it's going to take a while for the, you know, global supply of oil to, you know, move through the Hormuz, you know, through the straits to take oil prices down. And I don't think it'll make a lot of difference. I mean, his base is his base. I mean, I think he was correct in saying, you know, I could go out onto a street and shoot people dead. And
Fifth
and I would
Avenue
still,
specifically.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And his attorney, William Consovoy, you know, argued that during his first term that a president has the power to go outside of the White House and shoot somebody dead. And they can't be indicted. I mean, he argued that in a federal district court.
That's
so
crazy.
At least the message is consistent.
Yeah. Yeah. Anyway, so we'll see what happens. Lots of possibilities here. But clearly, this war is not popular with the American people. It's certainly not popular with the rest of the world. Something has to bring it to a close. And when it is finally done, it's probably not going to be a better situation than we had before the invasion. Is certainly not a better situation than what was negotiated during the Obama administration.
Yeah, and you know, much, much better for the government of Iran, which has been strengthened markedly.
Insane. Yeah. Anyway, hey, we're going to take a short break. When we come back, we're going to talk about an issue that I raised last week about the possibility that Donald Trump might be removed from office. We'll talk about that, and also a publication regarding authoritarianism called Varieties of Democracy. Jeffrey Weiss and myself, Ed Fallon, with you here. Back in a minute, and a quick reminder that underwriting for this program is provided by Dr. David Drake, a psychiatrist serving patients in Iowa and Colorado. More information at 515-229-5085.
Thanks to Central Iowa Realtor Joe Henry. Residential, commercial, land, Joe Henry's been covering all that for 23 years. He's also a leading community activist and a strong advocate for locally owned businesses. Call Joe Henry at 515-208-7312. That's 515-208-7312. You're responsible for a lot, and it's easy to become overwhelmed, to feel helpless, even hopeless. What's not so easy is finding your way back to feeling and functioning better. Psychiatrist Dr. David Drake helps individuals and couples throughout Iowa with the convenience and privacy of televideo counseling. Dr. Drake also prescribes medication when needed, and his services are offered on a self-pay, negotiated fee basis. If you need help, don't delay. Contact Dr. Drake at daviddrakefamilypsychiatry.com.
Welcome back to the Fallon Forum. This is Ed Fallon, your host, and my guest today, Jeffrey Weiss. Again, we're broadcasting from the heart of America's heartland, Des Moines, Iowa, with content that I hope, I believe, will be of interest to you wherever you are in the U.S. Underwriting for the Fallon Forum provided by real estate agent Joe Henry. More information at 515-208-7312. Hey, Jeffrey, so before we talk about varieties of democracy, which is a study I am not at all familiar with, so I'm looking forward to being enlightened by you, I want to talk about a conversation we had last week that was inspired by Robert Reich. He wrote a column based on a conversation he had with some folks he described as kind of political insiders. And I usually don't pay much attention to political insiders, but I thought they had a very interesting point. And that is that things are becoming so uncomfortable for the base of the Republican Party, with so many things going wrong with the Trump administration, that the insiders beyond Trump, I mean, Trump is there for his ego. He's a grifter. He's going to make as much money on this presidency as he possibly can. But there are those who are there for purely ideological reasons, and they are frightening ideological reasons. And I point to Stephen Miller in particular, but I don't exempt J.D. Vance or Marco Rubio. And the idea was that, you know, these folks see what's happening. They know they're going to get their back end swatted badly in November. They want to minimize the carnage. The way to do that is to get Trump out of there, bring about a reasonable, hopefully, you know, better, quote, deal to end the war in Iran, bring gas prices down, bring food prices down, start doing some things that bring the base of the Republican Party back home so that they vote they vote with Republican candidates for Congress, for example. And to do that, they propose, this is the theory, you know, Vance and Rubio are going to get the help of John Thune, Mike Johnson, to get them to help, along with Pete Hegseth and at least one other member of the cabinet, to get them involved in a plan to invoke the 25th Amendment, which says the president is not functionally able to, you know, to perform the duties of his office. And yeah, you can make a really strong case to that. I mean, I make that case all the time. And I think right now, between his decisions, his policy decisions, his insane midnight rants and reels and AI-generated attacks on any and everybody, and it is clear too that his mental and physical health are steeply declining. To me, yeah, there's a strong argument to be made. Even if you're not upset about policy, just physically, mentally, this president is not fully able to discharge the duties of his office, and he's a risk to the country. And probably more importantly to Rubio and Vance, he's a risk to the Republican Party. And so they're going to take whatever steps they need to make sure they can invoke the 25th Amendment and get rid of him in the near future. And most people disagree with me. Yeah. But I think Reich's people were onto something here. They gave it a 30% chance of actually being true. I put it even higher than that. Tell me why I'm wrong, Jeffrey.
Yeah, I would put it at about zero. And the reason I would is because if the 25th Amendment, I mean, that what we're talking about is Section 4, which I'll talk about in a minute. But Section 3 has been invoked a couple times. I believe Kamala Harris was president under Section 3 for an hour and a half when Joe Biden had a colonoscopy. And also George Bush Sr. when Ronald Reagan was shot.
All right.
You know, which, you know, incapacitation for a short period of time. But Article 4 is something different. It says that the vice president would need 8 members of the cabinet, a majority, because there's 15 members of the cabinet, you know, Secretary of War, Secretary of Interior, Secretary of Homeland Security. He would need 8 of those 15. All they would need to do is Vance signs it, those 8 sign it, they go to the Senate, they go to the House of Representatives, and they say the president is unfit for office. J.D. Vance immediately becomes president. At that point, the president would challenge that, and then
Trump
would challenge that. And by challenging that, he would become president again. And then we'd have a situation where we have then the cabinet and J.D. Vance would take it to the Senate and the House of Representatives, and they would have 48 hours to make an immediate decision. But if not, they would have 21 days to do a vote. Here's where the serious problem lies. In order to then remove the president from office in this contested situation, you would need 2/3 vote of the House of Representatives and 2/3 vote of the Senate.
Okay, so all
and
the Democrats,
I just think it's just
all
way
the Democrats,
too high.
And enough Republicans who are fed up with the way things are going.
All three of the Republicans that are fed up.
Well, I know. I think there are more. I think Vance and Rubio and these members of the cabinet probably have enough sway with enough members, especially if the two leaders Johnson and Thune are on board. You sure you want to stick with 0%?
The first hurdle is you have to get to the 8 members of the cabinet.
Sure.
And then after that, you need 2/3 of the House of Representatives and 2/3 of the Senate. And so I mean, maybe zero is a little strong. I feel like somebody who portrays themselves as Jesus, somebody who portrays, you know, who threatens to destroy 93 million people in a country that possesses nuclear weapons.
You're talking about Trump.
Yeah.
Because those two things are so compatible.
Yeah.
Thinking you're portraying yourself as Jesus and threatening to wipe out a civilization.
Yeah, I mean, I think if the president may have the unilateral option of dropping a nuclear bomb on another country. And it's actually interesting. You know, years ago when the United States used to accuse Fidel Castro of having too much power, he said, well, by the way, I can't push a button and destroy the human race. So your presidents have more power. But I just throw that out. I don't think that this would happen even if the president used a nuclear weapon and against another country. I don't think the cabinet would remove him.
I think Trump is unstable enough where he could decide to use a nuclear weapon, maybe not against Tehran, maybe against San Francisco. I don't know. You know, pick your most, quote, bluest city that he doesn't like. You know, I think there's enough awareness of that instability within the cabinet that there are, and this is small comfort, but there are some other players in, you know, on the stage there who are going to make sure that doesn't happen. They're, you know, he's going to go off on crazy rants at 3 a.m. with his tweets and whatnot.
Yeah.
But he's not going to be able to press a button in the middle of the night and drop a nuclear bomb anywhere.
Yeah, I feel that, you know, if there was pushback that the 4 or 5 Senate votes that could have been delivered to do a formal impeachment and end all of this on January 15th, you know, 2021 or whatever, you know, that never happened.
But impeachment, you know, means nothing. Impeachment is just,
well, it means you can't run again. So it would have,
well, okay, in his second term, big deal. Well, you mean back in his first term?
Back in his first term. Because, see, that's where 5 or 6 Republicans, that's where some Republicans did vote, you know, what was it, 57 votes or whatever. They needed 60. I mean, maybe, Ed, we could put it at 10%, but
so you've already went from 0% to 10%.
Well,
maybe if I keep talking, you'll get it up to 20 or 30. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I don't, you know, when you have a political party that turns into a personality cult, you know, in these particular times, the only real way to upset the cult is an election. And I just don't see that the party itself would take an initiative, because he's still popular amongst the base of the party, amongst
a shrinking percentage of the base.
That's true. But there isn't any alternative to him. I mean,
the alternative is Vance and the other people within the cabinet that Vance continued, that will pull along with him.
Yeah. If I don't see him getting aid, I mean, I see most of the cabinet members being far more loyal to him than they are to the Constitution and to the country, you know. So
I don't disagree, but I think what the even more important is they're loyal to the ability to continue to build this authoritarian regime. And to do that, you need a Republican Congress, Republican Senate, and basically, let's admit it, a Republican Supreme Court.
Right.
And
you already have all those things, and you'll probably have most of them for the next several decades, because the United States is not a democratic country, and we will be ruled probably by minority rule.
Well, the Supreme Court.
So the Republicans
sure
don't have to appeal to the electorate. There is no electorate to appeal to all you need is 30% to 40% of the vote to win elections.
Is there any doubt that the U.S.
We don't have majority rule.
The U.S. Congress is going to go democratic in the fall. No doubt, right?
Maybe not.
Well, I mean, gerrymandering is the one thing that might
absolutely
change that.
Yeah.
But
with the Voting Rights Act upended, it may not
sure
happen, and even if it does happen, it matters because of oversight from the House of Representatives. But it doesn't matter unless you have 60 votes in the Senate, because you can't overcome a filibuster anyway. So even if the Democrats control the Senate, you know, with 51-49, they'll be severely limited in what they can do other than budget and blocking appointments.
Blocking appointments, but also blocking policy is a pretty powerful thing to do. You know, when you're battling,
it's powerful, but it doesn't frighten the Republicans because they already got everything that they wanted for the most part, and they can't.
If you believe as I do that Steve Miller's goal, and I think Steve Miller is kind of the man behind the curtain, calling most of these shots, If you think, if you realize that his goal is complete domination by the administration of every element of government. And again, I blame previous presidents for helping to set the stage for this.
But
Democratic and Republican.
But Stephen Miller needs to stay behind the curtain because you don't want to get rid of your spokesperson, your best spokesperson. That would be my. I understand the argument, which is an interesting one. I don't disagree with you that there are people who want more authoritarianism. It's just that I think maybe even Stephen Miller knows that if he gets beyond outside of the curtain, the public's not going to like him.
I'm just pleased that I've been able to move you from 0% of support for my theory to 10%.
Yeah.
Okay.
Life is unpredictable, so who knows?
But something I know nothing about that you are very interested in that I think I will be once you start talking about it is a report called Varieties of Democracy. What is this?
Yeah, what's interesting to me is this is a think tank of 4,200 scholars based in University of Gothenburg in Sweden. And they look at all the countries of the United Nations, democracy, autocracy, and where they fit along the lines. They also analyze political parties. So for the first time in my lifetime, in my life, the United States has slipped into what they describe as some sort of autocracy. Now, they're borrowing that language from Stephen Levitsky of Harvard, who wrote an excellent book, How Democracies Die, and another one, Minority Rule. And they write that the United States has experienced, quote, a rapid and aggressive concentration of power in the executive presidency, unprecedented in modern history.
And did they say when that began?
They said it really began in the last 14 or 15 months, so quickly. You know, it took Putin, United Russia, a lot longer in the Russian Federation. Erdogan figured out that...
In Turkey.
Yeah, in the Justice and Development Party in Turkey, that they needed to get rid of the parliament and become a presidential republic. If you want executive power, that's your ticket. So Trump didn't have to find that out because we already have a presidential republic, which is a form of government that tends to lead towards executive tyranny. But this publication spells it all out. I really ask your audience to go online and read the report about the United States. It's pretty shocking in many respects how quickly this has happened. And what's even scarier is this did not take into account electoral changes. So
gerrymandering, for example.
Exactly. So if you add the, you know, sort of turning African Americans back to taxation without representation status in many southern states, this report even gets worse.
But I take exception to the notion that it's kind of been eroding over the last 14 to 15 months. I would say the last 50, 60 years. I mean, back during the Reagan administration, we started seeing an erosion of some of the pillars of democracy.
Sure, and I'm sure...
I mean, Fairness Act was one
example. Yeah, this publication and others wouldn't disagree with that. What they're saying, however, that is unique about the United States is how quickly it's happened and the politicization of the civil service, the war on cities declared by a president, the war on the First Amendment, the war on the press. Reporters Without Borders now says that this current administration is one of the great offenders of press freedom in the world. The United States is like 84th or something in the world right now in terms of academic freedom, which is an area that
84th.
I'm in. Yeah. And, you know, when I was born, the United States was in the top 10 in a lot of these different categories. And I mean, people in universities are just frightened right now because if the word woman appears in a study that is funded by the federal government, it's going to be DEI, you know, just woman or woman, you know, or socioeconomic or African American, you know. Mm. So that's sort of Soviet, style. We didn't have a big government that got into people's hospital rooms, in between the doctor or a big government that tried to run universities. I mean, universities have been, cherished, our university system is cherished around the world, but it really isn't nearly as much anymore because big government is trying to run our universities. And in this particular, in the federal system, in this particular
administration is writing executive orders to Harvard, which is a private university, essentially demanding a say in curricula.
Yeah.
I mean, that's nothing that I ever really thought I would see in the United States.
That would have made Joseph Stalin proud.
Absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, 40% of election officials have left since 2020.
It's kind of the American version of China's Cultural Revolution.
Well,
which is one of the best misnomers in political history.
Absolutely. And gerrymandering. I mean, other countries don't draw districts this way.
Like Iowa doesn't do it.
No. Right. People don't really realize that, you know, especially countries that have multi-member districts and proportional representation, which is the much more democratic form of voting anyway, which a lot of the democratic world has. It just makes it close to impossible to even gerrymander, even if you wanted to. But, you know, the idea that political parties should draw districts and that those districts should change every 10 years, you can't find that anywhere in the world. I mean, and so the United States had a lot of institutions which were really set up to be taken over by an executive.
That's my point about this. This isn't a 14 or 15 month thing.
And
the inequality.
The speed is.
Yeah.
And that's why.
Yeah. Hey, we got to take a short break. Jeffrey Weiss, a poli-sci prof from Des Moines Area Community College, where freedom still thrives, maybe.
Yes.
and Ed Fallon with you here, folks. Reminder that underwriting for the Fallon Forum is provided by Western Optometry. More information at 515-789-3055. Back in a minute, we'll be talking about Cuba. Thanks to our nonprofit partners, including Circle of Peacemakers. Formerly the Catholic Peace Ministry, Circle of Peacemakers works with people of all faiths toward a world without war. CPM opposes runaway military spending while domestic needs go unmet. Instead of endless wars, CPM supports diplomacy. Visit CircleOfPeacemakers.com. At Westrom Optometry, Dr. Joel Westrom and his team provide a variety of services, including comprehensive eye exams, children's eye exams, and LASIK co-management. Whether strictly utilitarian or a fashion statement, your comfort and vision are Westrom's primary concern. Dr. Westrom and his staff will work closely with you to determine the best solution for your eyes, prescription, and lifestyle. Services are provided in English and Spanish, and the clinic is open Monday through Friday from 9 a.m. till 5 p.m. and on Saturdays by appointment. That's Western Optometry, located in Des Moines East Village. Welcome back to the Fallon Forum. Ed Fallon with you here, folks. Hey, we're broadcasting from the heart of America's heartland, Des Moines, Iowa, with underwriting provided by Architecture by Synthesis. More at architecturebysynthesis.com. Jeffrey Weiss with me, folks, poli-sci prof from a Des Moines Area Community College. Cuba, and who knows, we're recording this program on Monday, Memorial Day, and who knows where this situation may end up by the time this program broadcasts on our affiliate stations around the nation, Wednesday, Thursday, and beyond. But as of now, Cuba, a very volatile situation. And the most recent kind of piece of shocking news is the the charges filed against a 94-year-old retired Cuban president, Raul Castro. And, you know, there's so many things here that are disturbing, where it might go, where it's been. Jeffrey, what's your take on the situation in Cuba?
Well, when we were talking about Iran, one of the things that Iranian officials have said, and time is on their side, is that if they can delay or make things difficult for the United States, they can also protect Cuba, which is interesting because it sort of takes us back to, you know, the days of the Cold War, you know, where you would have countries that would align against imperialist countries, or, you know, like
the Soviet Union.
The United States. Yeah. And so, you know, a lot of the rhetoric when it comes to Cuba is really that sort of anti-colonial. I mean, because the United States pretty much ran Cuba, you know, up until 1959.
After Spain did.
Yeah, exactly.
Spain did with the first imperial colonizers.
Yep. Well, in the United States from, 1898 roughly until 1959 was, you have your flag, we have your economy. It's a way of putting it. And we'll even make your flag look a little bit like ours. But ever since the United States sort of lost that playground, Republicans and Democrats and Kennedy and the big
when
names
say,
and money.
You mean Che Guevara.
Yeah,
yeah,
but
Fidel Castro.
Yeah, but before 1959, you had 25,000 prostitutes on the streets of Havana. It was a playground for rich,
during
business
the Batista
people.
Regime.
Exactly. Yep, yeah. Exactly. And so the United States has never forgiven Cuba for its independence, but also its economic nationalism. It doesn't really matter if you're a capitalist or a socialist or a communist, whatever you are, if you believe in sovereignty, economic sovereignty, or an economic nationalist, sort of in the style of Alexander Hamilton, you're a threat to U.S. business interests because your country's land, labor, and resources should be accessible to U.S. business. Then you're our friend, no matter how many of your own people you're killing or what death squads you set up, et cetera, El Salvador, Guatemala, et cetera, as long as you do business with us. So, there's a great document years ago that noted that Cuba's threat is its example. That if other countries take their own resources and produce and distribute and kick Budweiser out and make their own beer, or kick Pepsi out and make their own pop,
and
it's a threat to U.S. business.
And take land that has been basically stolen by foreign imperialists and redistribute that to indigenous farmers, to local people.
Exactly.
I mean, that's very very threatening to the U.S. I mean, we saw when that happened in Guatemala, when the government of José Arbenz, I believe I have his name correct, when he took control of the government in Guatemala, they began to redistribute some of the land that the United Fruit Company owned but wasn't using,
right?
And that was bad enough to inspire the CIA to initiate a coup and overthrow the Arbenz government.
Yeah, 1954, United Fruit, or Mossadegh in Iran, 1953, Allende in 1973
in Chile.
So, the difficult thing that Cuba has that definitely makes it not Iran, of course, on many levels, is that it's an island. It's a population of about 9.5 million. They've lost, a lot of people recently from migration, but also it's so close to the United States. So the United States has had so much power to restrict other countries from doing any business with Cuba. Right now, essentially, it's not called an oil blockade, but it's pretty much that. As you take Venezuelan oil out of Cuba's economy, you threaten Mexico not to sell oil. So, the United States uses the power of the petrodollar and the power of the dollar as the dominant currency in the world to punish countries when it can, and Cuba is a country that can really easily be isolated and punished. And so Cuba's in an extremely difficult situation.
But we've been punishing Cuba since 1959.
Right.
And they've survived. At first with the help of the Soviet Union, which collapsed in 1989, and yet Cuba has survived.
They have the real difficult thing for Cuba now is the stranglehold on energy that the United States has. And the really
oil specifically.
Absolutely. And really the revolution itself, was more successful in terms of the solidarity of the population, anti-colonial, before cell phones, and because cell phones tend to create, just like in our society, a more of a individualistic living in a vacuum, kind of a human being, and more of a consumeristic, lifestyle. And so, we'll see where this goes. I don't imagine the United States using military force against Cuba as long as Iran continues and also the World Cup. But, the same time, this administration has two more years.
Unless J.D. Vance takes over.
Well, and Cuba is no threat to the United States. We know that.
So, Why won't the Trump administration try to do the same thing it did in Venezuela? Basically, going in, capturing in this case, Maduro, the president of Venezuela, and interestingly, replacing him with his vice president. So basically, regime change? No, not so much. Just changing the person in charge of the regime.
Right.
Why won't they try to do the same thing in Cuba?
They may. They may. And
they've already got this indictment against 94-year-old Raul Castro.
Yeah. No, I mean, we don't know what will happen, especially the last 2 years of this administration, but it is possible that they'll do this. And depending on how many civilians they kill in the process, the Cuban people may be like the Iranians, where we say, you know, we're not super fond of our government, but we like Iran more, you know, or we're not super fond of our government, but we like Cuba more. And, you know, any kind of a land invasion or something like that could be very costly to whoever is involved and whoever's on the ground in another illegal war.
And I know you've been to Cuba, and I'm always shocked by this. I was shocked that, and I've read about how the rebels accomplished the overthrow of Batista, and it's almost amazing that they pulled it off. But what's mostly amazing is that the U.S. wasn't able to stop it, and that even after Fidel Castro, along with Che Guevara and others, other revolutionaries were installed. It's just amazing that the U.S. government didn't just come in and say, no, we're not going to have any of this. I mean, we've done that in other countries. Yeah. How did Cuba get away with this?
Yeah. I mean, I think there were a lot of factors that, you know, Cuba had some real strong political leadership that, in terms of guerrilla warfare, decided you don't kill civilians. You know, that won't make you popular. You know?
Yeah.
And really, you know, the situation of, 58% literacy, you know, people in Cuban rural areas, especially being in a lot of poverty, you know, life expectancy, you know, barely 55 or something like that. There was considerable deprivation, and the revolution took place over a long period of time. And really, the U.S. intelligence and the elite, which was too busy chasing prostitutes on the streets of Havana rather than reading intelligence, really underestimated the power of the movement, which was a popular revolution. You know, and I mean, I became interested in Cuba in the 90s when I was looking at World Health Organization statistics, and Cuba had a life expectancy that was about the same as the United States. And I said, this can't be right, because their per capita income is only 2,000. So, you know, I went to Cuba two times. The second time I went illegally, when I was a student, we challenged the travel ban. We essentially said, arrest us if you want to. Treasury Department confiscated.
Didn't?
No, it was Global Exchange. It was Medea Benjamin that helps to run Code Pink now. Their organization, the Treasury Department confiscated all of our money. They threatened us to go. When our delegation was able to get money from other places, Cubana Airlines flew us there. My interest at the time was that freedom. I mean, I grew up believing in this, talking about this F word that we don't talk about much anymore, called freedom. You know, everything is safety now, right? I sometimes say to my students, like, you can be safe in North Korea. You know, you can still dance salsa in North Korea and go out. If you want safety, you know, you can find it. Everything is safety now, but freedom was a thing when I was a kid. And so I was like, yeah, why are we not free to go to Cuba? You know, people from all around the world visit there. So I said, I'll be free, right? We weren't arrested. We were harassed when we came back. The TSA people at the airport, Medea Benjamin's daughter was like 14. She had a shirt on Cuba, and they told her in public to take her shirt off, and she started crying, etc. So they harassed
certain people more
than others.
Why did they want to take her shirt off?
Well, because she bought it in Cuba, and if you go to Cuba illegally, you cannot buy any Cuban products and bring them back, and her shirt was made in Cuba. So I guess what I'm saying is the TSA people were a little petty, or the border people, because they were picking on teenagers, and you know, they picked on Medea more. They sent probably somebody to sit with me on one of my trips who asked a lot of questions. And anyhow, I just sort of laughed. And my luggage was lost for long periods of time at O'Hare.
Mysteriously.
On my way back. Yeah, exactly. But I was entertained by all of it. yeah, I mean, because I grew up in a country that, you know, you read Jefferson, you read the founders. I mean, whatever one wants to say about the founders of this country, you know, people cannot exist both ignorant and free. I mean, they had a lot of strong ideas, you know.
So, one more question. Do you think Cuba is going to be able to withstand whatever kind of pressure the Trump administration brings against it?
That's an excellent question. And really, I don't know. And what discourages me about saying to you, I don't know, is 10 years ago, I would have said yes. 20 years ago, I would have said yes. 30 years ago, I would have said yes. But I really don't know now because the level of deprivation is...
In this country.
In Cuba. Cuba is at a point where revolution. It could be that the Cubans say, whatever comes after this might not be as bad as what we're living with. And if we live on the doorsteps of the United States of America, this is sort of the price we pay for our sovereignty.
Yeah. Jeffrey, thanks so much for joining us today, folks. Jeffrey Weiss has been my guest. When I come back from a short break, Kathy Burns will join me for our farm and food conversation. Underwriting provided by Dr. Kim Holding with Story County Veterinary Clinic, serving Story County pets for over 30 years. More information at Story County Veterinary Clinic's Facebook page. Architecture by Synthesis provides planning, design, and design-build services for high-performance, low-maintenance, affordable homes and buildings. Owner Mark Clipsham asks that you use the most energy-efficient methods you can afford and the greenest, longest-lasting materials available. Examples of Mark's work can be found at architecturebysynthesis.com. That's architecturebysynthesis.com.
At Story County Veterinary Clinic, Dr. Kim Holding has over 30 years of experience working with all creatures, great and small. Cat, dog, horse, cow, elephant. Well, if you've got a pet elephant, you may be in trouble. Kim's clients stick with her year after year because they know she'll do right by them and their pets and farm animals. So give Kim a shout to keep your animals happy and healthy. Call 515-232-8766. That's 232-8766.
Welcome back to the Fallon Forum. Underwriting for this program provided by Gateway Market, a Des Moines grocery and cafe offering artisan, local, and global foods and catering for business and social events. More information at gatewaymarket.com. Hey, Kathy, welcome to the program.
Howdy.
And you've been doing some cow research.
Well, I grew up around a lot of cattle. I was never a cattle keeper myself.
Cattle keeper.
And
I did some cattle keeping in Ireland.
Yes. Yeah. Well, I mean, I used to go, you know, go out in the pasture with them a little bit. Watch them birth. But a few years back, we talked to a cattle producer who told us about some of these CRP programs.
Conservation Reserve Program.
That incentivize people with land, farmers, to put some of that aside for conservation purposes. And she was telling us that when you disallow those lands to be used for grazing, cattle especially, maybe sheep, that you are doing the land a disservice. You're not fully using what you have to regenerate the land.
And I want to say there's like 20 million acres of farmland in the U.S. that is now in the Conservation Reserve Program. And it's in my experience, it's a good program. It allows marginal land, often hilly land, erodible land, to be put into basically rewilding it, which helps control erosion, but also provides habitat. It's been, I mean, pheasants forever.
Yes.
Pheasant hunters love CRP land.
It creates a lot of good wildlife area.
But the argument by the ranchers and cattle producers is interesting because it does make a good point.
Right now, there is, I think it's a 75-year low in available grazing land, and according to some of the farmers in some of the recent news articles, but in at least four states, Iowa, Colorado, North Dakota, and Texas, cattle producers are actively trying to influence Congress to change some aspects of the farm bill that disallow grazing on CRP land.
So their request is to allow some CRP land, and I wonder what the threshold or the criteria would be to accommodate grazing. And you know, I try to think of it as in a natural way. Well, how do ecosystems actually work? Well, you know, the prairie prior to European colonization, did a pretty good job at accommodating grazing. And the prairie for those of you not from flat country, prairie country, it's not all flat.
It's
in
not.
In fact, we have the closest native prairie to Des Moines, Cedar Prairie, is a hillside prairie.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so there are plenty of places where prairie is pretty rolling.
But the deep roots of those prairie plants can actually be enhanced by the tugging action of cattle's teeth on that plant. It strengthens them from below and helps them to regenerate.
Right, but most of the plants growing on CRP land are not native prairie, prairie plants.
Right. But they're saying that if more of these could be used as cover and then allow for grazing, the reason that there's so much diminishment of grazing land right now is this drought, and that has led to not just the dry land, but also the lack of water in general. I mean, both those things, yeah. They sound, mutually exclusive.
Sure, the land is thirsty, but so are the cattle,
right,
that are trying to
right.
make a living off it. Yeah, and again, I think the reason beef herd is down, the lowest it's been in 75
yes.
years, that's a complicated conversation because a lot of it has to do with imports of beef from other countries, a control of the packing industry
mm-hmm.
by, what, three big players,
mm-hmm.
one of them owned by China,
mm-hmm.
another one owned by a Brazilian firm. I mean, we're basically seeing a new type of colonization in rural America.
Mm-hmm.
Colonization for our soil, for our crops and our livestock, and also for our wind energy. I mean, wind energy is being extracted from rural states and being sent to high-density urban areas.
Mm-hmm.
I think we have to admit that, it's not a matter of living on the land anymore. It's what they can take from the land.
And the cattle producers are also saying that they want to see any way that the USDA can help expand grazing land, because right now, as we've talked about before in this program, there's a real slowdown. In fact, it's almost harder and harder all the time for young farmers, the would-be farmers, to get into this this profession and this life calling, as they would see it. And so yeah. creating a system for increasing the amount of farmland or grazing land would encourage that too.
This reminds me of the work of, and I can't remember the fellow's name, but he's done great work in parts of Africa to reverse desertification through rotational grazing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And again, part of it is just let's do what nature did,
mm-hmm.
or let's let nature do what it does, you know. And you don't have grazing land or CRP land or woodlands that are devoid of animals.
Right.
So
yeah. Diversity is best.
I'd love to hear what the con side of this is, but to me, it makes sense. Yeah. Hey, Kathy, thanks for doing some digging into this conversation.
You betcha.
And thanks to my guest today, Jeffrey Weiss. Thanks to our production squad of Sherry Herdina, Forrest Detterman, Charles Goldman, and Kathy Burns. Thanks also to the Des Moines Irish Session for our bumper music. Underwriting provided by Gateway Marketing Cafe, Story County Veterinary Clinic, Western Optometry, David Drake Family Psychiatry, Architecture by Synthesis, and Real Estate Agent Joe Henry. Underwriting also provided by Circle of Peacemakers, Iowa Physicians for Social Responsibility, Bold Iowa, Birds and Bees Urban Farm, and Climate March. This is Ed Fallon, your host, and we'll be back next week with another hour of Cutting Edge Talk Radio.